Welcome to Frontline, the podcast talking about the issues affecting health, social and community workers in the UK. We're here to talk about the topics important to you and give insight on tackling the professional dilemmas which might be affecting you day to day. Hello and welcome to Frontline. My name's Chris Slater.
And I'm Dave Gill.
Welcome to today's show. How are we doing, Dave?
Yeah, good, good. I'm excited for episode number two. If you haven't already listened to episode one, we were discussing SPICE, or synthetic cannabinoid receptor agonist. I suggest you check it out.
Indeed, check it out from wherever you may get your podcast from. We will be there. We'd love to have you on board. So on today's show, we are talking about psychologically informed environments, or PI, as they're more commonly known. So, Dave, just to lead us into this, what are we talking about exactly when we talk about psychologically informed environments?
Well, it's interesting you ask that because it might be a simple question, but unfortunately it's not a simple answer.
There was only some kind of podcast that can explain all of this.
Well, exactly. So I guess there is a bit of a basic answer we can give, and then I think we need to explore it in some depth. Put simply, the idea behind it is services getting to a point where they are incredibly self-aware of their interactions, their behaviours with their service users by putting the service user at the centre of everything they do. And in doing that, think about everything. How do they respond? How do they engage with that person? Are we focusing on empathy? Are we focusing on positive strengths-based approaches? What about our building, our environment? What about the words, the phrases? Everything that we use, how do we currently use them and how can we change them for the better to be more psychologically informed, therefore helping the people we work with and maybe within services, hopefully, you actually have a better experience yourself, increase your job satisfaction.
Okay, so let's start drilling down into this. But I think before we start breaking it down into what it is and really how it can be built and created, from what I understand, it's actually a relatively recent concept. But where do we know roughly when or where it originated from?
This is the problem. Because it has been a movement, it's very hard to pin down exactly where it has come from. And I think it's kind of irrelevant to worry too much about where it's come from, because I think the momentum that it's gathered, that for me is the key element here. But you are probably looking about 2008 is kind of the time it started to gather momentum. Around about 2013, we saw some pioneers. I'm aware of a little bit of a pun there, pioneers, in terms of implementing these toolkits, these ideas to really, really ensure that this sort of stuff is embedded. Because the interesting thing with it is once services start to invest in it and embed it into services, they no longer think in a PI perspective. It just becomes the norm. So some services that have been using it perhaps don't even think about it anymore. Those that are yet on the journey don't even think of it because they've not become aware of it. Then you've got the services in the middle that are kind of on their journey somewhere.
So just to make sure that I've understood this correctly, so it's not really a prescriptive approach as such. It's more of a renaissance as opposed to a revolution.
There's as much focus on the reflections as there is on implementation. It's advised that first step is really looking at everything that you currently do. How do you engage with service users? The questions, the ability to make changes. Do we utilise strengths-based approaches? Are we all focused on deficits?
That's a really good point. And I think a good question to be asking ourselves from the outset is, in the title psychologically informed environments, does it actually need any kind of psychological input? Do we need a psychologist, essentially?
Again, I think this is one of the areas where a lot of services maybe are fearful about looking at this or maybe taking their first steps into this world, because you hear that term, psychologically informed, and there is a bit of an assumption that you need a clinical psychologist to be involved to kind of come into your service, tear it all apart, rebuild it. And when you hear about that, I think the worry is someone is coming in, completely tearing everything up, taking complete control over it and taking some of the control away.
Well, just to weigh up the opposite side of that, is there, in theory, would there be any benefit to someone coming in and doing that?
With it being a journey, what I would say and what the evidence tells us, if you have at your disposal, you have it within your budget to hire in a range of different people, such as psychologists, maybe other professionals, people with a different perspective on how you do things and be able to look at it from a different point of view, that can only help things. But we know in this field there is not a ton of money swimming around. You need to be in a position where you, your teams, your colleagues, your management structure buy into this and look at how you can make improvements.
So really, we're looking at how we can actually make the most or indeed improve on what we already have, as opposed to actually adding to it with any kind of finance or indeed any kind of additional external input.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons why, if you clock the path of psychologically informed environments, there's no surprise it goes hand in hand with austerity measures. Because the more we see being removed from services, the more we see services having to do more with less. And what a psychologically informed approach tells us is that you can revisit everything you currently do, make some small tweaks, and in some cases maybe some larger tweaks, and start to see some really, really positive results.
So one word which leapt out at me there was approach. That's what kept resonating with me. Let's start there. So how do we go about creating a psychologically informed environment? What's our first step in the approach?
The steps that we're going to talk about now are very much seen as an ongoing journey with everyone being involved where possible. So the first step has to be a buy-in, basically. You need to have people buying into this. And when I say people, I mean everyone. So you need to think about your management structure, whether it's senior managers down to frontline managers. If you have support services, you need them involved. We need our frontline workers, absolutely key in all this. Admin staff, reception staff, whoever you have in your services. Secondly, we need to be in a position where we can get everyone or as many of those people in a room together.
Really, we're looking at a very much a cooperative approach, a think tank.
Yes, it's very much a non-hierarchical approach. And I think the joy of this, if you are a manager, senior manager or frontline manager, the joy for you is you empower people. You truly empower people to make a lot of decisions. And it takes some pressure off yourself. If you're a frontline worker, the joy of this is you get to shape your future.
I suppose you actually are having more of a say in how you're actually implementing the work that you're doing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the last group of people to be involved in this, and I think it's important to kind of put some focus on this, is your service users themselves. The people who are actively using your service, say if you are a housing service, get some people, some residents in, get them in to your meetings and ask them, what is it like using our service? What experience do you have? What's it like when you walk into the building? What's it like when we ask you questions? How do we treat you? Do you feel human?
Let's talk about that for just a moment, because that's actually a really interesting point. The amount of, you know, services that we all use day to day, and you get a survey which no one really takes the time to sort of fill out. How can people kind of get over that barrier and better engage with service users to get their input?
Well, I think the key is what you just said there, engage. Because if you hand out a really simple questionnaire, piece of paper, ticks and boxes, there's a detachment there. You don't feel like you are truly shaping change. And I sometimes feel that myself. You know, when you get emailed or text a questionnaire to fill in, I am pretty bad at filling those in.
Because I find them highly frustrating, and I never bother with them, to be honest.
Yeah, because there is that lack of understanding of what they're going to do with this information. Am I even going to get any feedback of the positive impact that I can have on people?
Additionally, are you actually going to get honest feedback?
Again, that's another issue. By having it in writing and asking people to put it in, even if it's anonymized, sometimes people aren't truly honest. So I think, as you said earlier on, the key word is engagement. So it cannot feel tokenistic. It cannot feel Bob and Sue are coming in because they are residents and we'll just have them for 5 minutes and ask them to leave. We need to truly bring them in, ask them, get them involved as much as they want to be involved, as much as they feel safe to do so, to truly get an understanding of how they feel. And those that get involved in this need to be involved throughout, or at least receive feedback on what their views have done, so that they can understand that their impact has meant something and it hasn't just been a tick box tokenistic gesture.
Okay, so far we're getting input from everyone involved, obviously, in said service, and indeed the service users as well, for the duration. So what's the next step? Where do we take it from there?
It really is drilling down and really thinking about where everyone's skills currently lie and how we utilise those skills, how we utilise our values. And I think in this industry, we have to be values-led. We have to care. Because ask many a frontline worker, Chris, why they get into this line of work, and I can guarantee you it's not for the money. They do it because they care. They do it because they are value-led. So because of that, we need to be almost in a position where we are bringing our values to the table, bringing the service values to the table, and thinking about where we are. Are we having an opportunity to use these values? Do we feel we can make a positive impact on someone's life?
And indeed, do the existing values of said service actually still hold up?
Very good point. The joy of this is people might actually look at their values and go, this may have been relevant 10, 15 years ago when the charity or the organisation started, but right here, right now, maybe it's not meeting our needs, maybe it's not meeting our service users' needs. So you're absolutely right. It's a wonderful opportunity to almost give everything a once-over, to really look at what you have. So this first stage is thinking about the groundwork. How do we see things? How are our values utilised? And then thinking about people in the room, so we can get different perspectives as well. When someone walks into a room, am I on autopilot? Do I just say, right, you've come in here, we need to get you housed, we'll do X, Y, and Z, and not think about what is going on for that human being? What support do they truly need? We can start to see the human again. So this is almost bringing us back to why we get into this line of work anyway.
Okay, so we're getting input from everyone. We're looking at the original value system. We're challenging it if necessary, or we're adding to it, we're improving it. What's next?
So this whole stage needs to build into a bit of a action plan, an approach to really think about what is our next steps. It's like anything. If we can put some accountability in there and go, right, you know what? We worked out that the people over here who do this, if we could just start to move things around over here, we can start to see some improvement. Right, step one. People over here, step two, what can you do?
And indeed, accountability is such a huge part of implementing change, isn't it? Because it's all very well saying, oh, well, this aspect of our service isn't working, or this particular area doesn't quite meet people's needs. But at the end of the day, if people aren't prepared to be accountable and say, actually, do you know what? No, it isn't. We need to make that change. Then obviously it's a bit of a push-pull kind of scenario. Sometimes it can be quite a challenging thing getting everyone in the same room together, especially if there's going to be if there's been quite an established hierarchy for a very long period of time. Yeah. Some of the lower level, perhaps, members of staff might not feel comfortable airing their views in front of more senior management. So how can we get about making it a kind of a safe forum for that to be able to happen?
Because we are talking about this being a non-hierarchical approach, but you need the hierarchy to give the green light at this. You need the senior managers to say, we are going to do this, because that is where we need the hierarchy.
It links back to what you said a moment ago about everyone needs to buy in.
Yes, so that accountability has to start with the management. So we're not saying we chuck the management out and we have utter chaos in services, but they are the people that goes, right, you know what, we are going to do this. We know it's going to be a culture change. We know that it's going to be hard work to begin with, but long term, it's going to be positive. So that, for me, before people even get into that room, that is how we can have our first win. The managers are implementing this and are honest and transparent with their staff why they are wanting to do what they are doing.
Okay, so we've got an agreement about we want to change the culture. We need to have a culture shift in terms of the service that we are providing. What's the next step from there? I mean, bearing in mind, obviously, as you said before, you know, resource is limited, finances are limited, budget is limited. So it's a very, very narrow margin to be operating in. How can we start making those improvements with that very narrow margin being factored in?
I think whatever you do next, whatever you agree to, that accountability, those plans have to be stuck to, because it's no good talking about this. It's no good thinking about this if we 6 months later go, I'm not feeling this, it's not going to work. You will lose faith in all your staff, your service users, and it could all fall apart. So it needs that buy-in, that continuous buy-in. When those plans are put in place, there has to be a realistic conversation about what is our budget, what can we afford? And that includes external consultants, if, and I can't emphasize this enough, if you can afford it, maybe specific therapists, counselors, someone external, an external consultant, again, just someone with a different frame of mind to you that can come in. If you can't afford that, or that's not realistic for you, again, think about how frontline workers or service users can take a lead on things.
Just before we go any further, I just wanted to establish, I think it's important for our listeners to establish, it's not a quick fix, is it?
It's a culture change. It is something that will take time. And it will take an investment up front. And we're not talking a huge pound sign for a lot of people, but maybe a huge effort sign for a lot of people.
So really, at the core of this kind of process, it's not all about short-term wins. We're looking at very much the long-term game and, of course, the long-term positive results. It's going to require, obviously, input. It's going to require a lot of patience and dedication to make it work, but the results are most definitely worth it. So now we've got the agreement from everyone. We know we want to make a difference. We know what we can do within our means. Taking that to a more practical level, where do we begin?
For me, it has to be around the training and support. If you can afford it, it's recommended some in-depth training around psychologically informed environments. So the idea is we need some sort of formal training to be done, where you need your staff an external trainer to come in, kind of talk through what this process is, what it means, and how you can see it, encourage reflection, encourage positivity. And what that does is, it, from a management perspective to the staff, it shows that they feel invested in, because not only are we saying we're buying into this, we're even ensuring formal training for you.
I suppose one other benefit that's just occurred to me is that it's also improving lines of communication amongst staff as well, isn't it? And of course, it's giving a kind of universal language, as it were.
Yes, absolutely. It creates that consistency and that feeling that you've got each other's back. You are a high-performing team. So stage one has to be that training, so make sure that everyone is on the same page and understanding. So really, that pre-step is getting everyone in, agreeing, accountability, understanding this culture change. Stage two is very much around the training and the support. And by that, we mean things like utilising your supervision with your management, embedding into your service reflective practice sessions, so getting you and your colleagues around and talking about what's going on for you, how you can continuously develop. So creating an open and honest culture, therefore a safe culture, where we are constantly developing. We're not holding everything to ourselves and going, oh my God, I've got so much to do, but I'm just going to keep it to myself.
Okay, so we've established lines of communication. We've had the training. We know roughly where our starting points are. So how's that going to translate into what we're doing day to day?
The training should be the starting point, not the end. So the next step has to be continuing that culture. So reflective practice, it can't just be a tokenistic gesture. It has to be embedded. Analysing the approaches that we do, analysing the paperwork, starting to analyse the buildings that we're in, where we're located, who do we come into contact with, starting to really unpick everything and almost doing a constant audit on ourselves, going, what are we good at? What can we develop?
And I suppose it's also not being afraid to ask those questions and casting the net a bit wider too, as you say, not just necessarily what we're doing in terms of providing a service, but where we're providing the service.
It's very easy. If your service has been around for many, many years, you are used to aiming at a specific group of people. That group of people comes in, you respond appropriately. When something different happens, it can throw you off. If you don't create an environment where you're constantly learning and adapting, something new comes onto the scene and you go, oh my God, I'm fearful. So we need to create a culture that understands that what walks through the door could be different, could be constantly evolving, constantly changing, and we are in a position where we can feel we can meet whatever needs walk through that door.
So let's say that I'm running a service, then I've done everything that you've mentioned up until this point, almost to the letter. How can we actually prove that this is actually working?
Well, this is the interesting one, because, again, if you think about this from the perspective of a local authority that commissions a service, or from a senior management, despite looking at this and going, I like it in theory, however, my role tells me I need outcomes. I need cold, hard facts to tell me whether or not this is working. There has to be a bit of an understanding that in the short term, you might not see much change. And in fact, what it also might mean is that you actually have to rethink what your outcomes are, what your key performance indicators are, because you might be measuring things that aren't irrelevant. You might need to measure things that actually you haven't been measuring before.
So as well as obviously challenging the value system that a service may have, it's also perhaps challenging even how it's being measured, the KPIs, like you said before.
Yeah, because again, if you think about a drug service, for years, the main tick in the box was, is this person drug-free? If you've dropped out of treatment, that's a bad thing. So that person might have come in, reduced their drug use, reduced their criminal behaviour, had a massive positive impact on their local community, being part of a recovery group, but they're still using on occasion, whereas on maybe our recording tools, that is deemed to be not such a positive outcome.
Okay, so just out of interest, and this is more my own curiosity than anything else, so say, for example, we have an organisation that has, you know, quite a long established history of doing things a certain way.
Yeah.
We now have this new process or new way of thinking. Can the two run concurrently, or does one have to completely overtake?
Interesting. My thoughts on this is, if you start down the journey of pie, you have to accept that that's the angle you're going down. You cannot accept that the old way is just going to tick along in the background. I'm trying to think of a better way of describing it than this, but you've got to think about this as a positive virus, bit by bit taking over the old ways of doing things to a point where everything just becomes pie. The weird thing is, when everything does become pie, you stop seeing it as pie and you just start going, this is just the norm. This is just how we do things. So if we had that old way alongside Pi, you would always have a conflict. You would always have old way, we are results-based, we just get people through the door. New way is, yes, we get results, but we also focus on that person.
I suppose another way of thinking about it is, you know, the old way of, say, record-keeping, where people were writing things by hand on paper, keeping them in files, and now we live in the digital age where everything's obviously computerized. We have the internet, everything's much more readily accessible and much more efficient.
If we'd have kept half doing paper records and half doing computer records, we'd have chaos.
I just want to go back briefly to something you mentioned about the spaces that services are operating in and the buildings that they use. How do these actually impact on the service user?
What's interesting about this is that what Pi has done is it kind of brought this as something vital as opposed to an afterthought. Classically, we didn't really think about the paperwork or the buildings. You've got the staff, you've got your structure, you've got your values, and then you went, right, we need a building, quick, let's just get that decrepit building over there. We need an assessment form, just get some questions on a piece of paper. No one really put a lot of thought into what we needed to go into this. Or if we did, we did it from a results-based approach or an outcome-based approach. What this Pi approach tells us, we really need to be thinking about the entire environment. So when you walk into that building, how welcome do you feel? How safe do you feel? If you're meeting someone in the community, where do you meet that person? The power of writing as well. Thinking about what's written down on questions. How do we ask people things? For example, if I just met you and I'm a service trying to get you some housing, I've not even built up a relationship. And if I ask you, Chris, so have you ever committed any serious crimes? How would you respond?
Not well. That's quite an intense question to be asking someone straight off the bat.
Also, imagine I've not even created any sort of relationship with you, and I follow that up with, so are you feeling suicidal today, Chris?
Wow. Good Lord. That's quite full on.
Oh, how about, have you got any kids? If you do, where are they now? Do you look after them? How does that all feel?
That's four questions in one, and that's quite a lot of information to be taking in in one go. Especially if, say, for example, I'm in quite vulnerable circumstances.
Absolutely. And we've just assumed that we're asking these questions, we're using our environments, our buildings, for the greater good. And actually, what we are potentially doing is shutting that person off from being truly honest. If you think walking through that door, it's horrible, it's grey, it's depressing, you meet a receptionist who doesn't engage you, you then sit in a waiting room, it's cold, it's damp, you are scared, you then go into a room where you ask those intrusive questions. I don't know about you, but if I went through that, I'd walk out onto the street and go, I'm not going back there again.
Indeed. And in fact, that really highlights what we were talking about earlier about communication and having the same kind of language. It's not just about, obviously, staff, but it's actually how we communicate to the people that we are providing this service for. Yeah. Is the language we're using friendly and accessible?
As a professional, creating an environment where you can create positive, safe relationship. So if someone comes in, I might need to find out about whether or not you are suicidal.
So what would you feel that the better approach would be?
So firstly, you would want a safe building. So you would come in, feel safe. The receptionist engages you. The waiting room feels safe. You're offered a drink. There's maybe a radio on in the background. There's bright colours. Again, we are not creating an environment where this person feels I'm already at a low point and I've walked into the worst environment ever that's reinforcing that I'm feeling rubbish. So we need to create that environment. And then when you walk in that room with a professional, the pen and paper or iPad and whatever it may be to record the information gets pushed to one side. Hi, Chris, my name is Dave. How are you today? Something as simple as that. And as things go on, you can even ask, so how's your mood today? How are you feeling? You can then explore with that person to a point where you can find out maybe if they're feeling down, not such a good place, and find out if they're feeling suicidal that way, rather than not even met you and I'm going to ask you these questions.
So we're thinking about asking more open-ended questions to give yourself an avenue where you can actually ask the questions that need to be asked and you can tick the boxes that need to be ticked.
Yes, and that links to two key approaches that we're going to cover in some later episodes, particularly motivational interviewing, which is about that open-ended approach. Fits in beautifully with Pi, and also a strengths-based approach. You are always looking at that person thinking, what are you capable of doing? How can I help you improve? As opposed to, what's wrong with you? How can I fix you? Because let's face it, we cannot fix that person.
Just out of interest, I mean, it seems relatively simple in terms of how that can be implemented, but are there any other kind of examples of where that's actually been done?
The one area where I could see elements of this, and I imagine they probably wouldn't call it this approach, is in banks.
In banks?
Yes, yeah. So I imagine you go to, you went into a bank 10, 15 years ago. It was a very cold, clinical, bright lights environment. You stood in rows, you waited in turn to meet a cashier. And through this horrible bulletproof glass, you had to kind of scream what you wanted to do because that person couldn't hear you. You had to kind of disclose your money situation for everyone around you to hear. It wasn't a pleasant experience. And what would tend to happen is that incidents of anger, frustration, aggression towards staff was relatively high. And a lot of that setup was based around the odd percent of someone coming in with a shotgun and holding the bank up. They realise the chances of that ever happening are so unbelievably small, yet that's what we've prepped for. Maybe we need to rethink it. What's it like now if you go into a bank, Chris?
Well, I'll be honest, I rarely visit the bank anymore because I, like most people, use online banking. However, I did have a need to go to a branch because I needed to pay in something physical. So when I went in, I noticed quite a stark contrast because, like I said, it's been many, many years since I actually visited a branch. It was all very automated. A lot less cashiers there. Obviously, there were members of staff to help out should you need them, but a lot of it is actually automated now, and I was able to actually conclude my business just by using a machine.
That's the interesting thing with banks, because if you look, they've almost taken a similar approach. You've got online, but if you choose not to use online, you walk into a bank, the lighting is a lot lower. There's usually there with someone with a clipboard or an iPad to meet you, ask you how you are. If you don't need them, you can go and use these machines. You don't have to disclose things. And I saw everything. I saw like sofas out there. I saw there was no counters. There wasn't any bulletproof glass. And what that meant was that it's person-centered approach. Rather than waiting for a crisis of someone kicking off, they're creating a safe environment, limiting the chance that will ever happen.
And another word that springs to mind now, I've had a chance to think about it a bit more when I went in, spacious.
Yes.
The building hasn't changed, but there seemed to be a lot more space in there.
Exactly. So usually the buildings very rarely change, but how people use the buildings, that was so important. I'm not saying that we all need to become banks, but if we look at a bank and look at how branches have changed, obviously they're doing it for very different reasons to what we would be doing it for, but it does give us an idea.
Do you think it's fair to say they're socially ergonomic?
Yes. Yes, I would, Chris.
Bringing it back to the health, social and community organisation sector. Say, for example, we're a service, we've implemented this new way of thinking, this new strategy, and we've done it for quite an extended period of time now. How can we tell that it's worked?
With a pie approach, we are talking about it being an approach. We're talking about being a journey. And one of the frustrations with recording it, when they get a really positive change in their service, they no longer start to talk about it from a pie perspective. But when they get to where they need to be, it's almost like they don't need to use pie anymore. And it's just the norm now. And it's hard to compare different services and how they've done things, because people are at different points in their journeys. All services are different. So it's hard to then compare it. What's interesting in this field, one of the biggest debates at the minute, is encouraging a way for us to find out a solution to how we can compare it. We're not quite there yet. But what I would say is if you do implement this, you do see changes.
One of the major things that I'm taking away from all of this is that from the outset, from its very inception, it's not a prescriptive approach.
Absolutely.
It's not something that can be shoehorned in anywhere. It's not a one size fits all. At the end of the day, all it is, it's just a different way to perceive the services and the systems and the processes that you're already using. It's more of a catalyst for evolution of those systems and processes and services that you're providing. It's not a short-term Mr. Fix-It solution.
The joy of this as well is the service users get a better service because they feel safer, they feel secure, they feel listened to, they feel valued, they're more likely to open up, they're more likely to engage, they're more likely to get a better outcome, a better improvement on their lives, which means services wins, workers feel better because they feel more empowered to take some lead on this, and management feel better because they don't feel like they have to make all their decisions. They can ensure that it's a culture of learning and input, and everyone plays a part.
Two ways we can sum it up is accessibility, and it's much more engaging.
I think anything that we can do that is positive and is engaging and helps people, we should be embracing it with both hands.
And I think the other main thing to take away is that this is not a master plan, it's just a way to use and deploy what we already have much more positively. If you are a service provider where you've encountered this kind of approach, drop us an email and let us know, because at the end of the day, this show is designed around you and with you in mind, so we'd love to hear your input. Now, time for Quick Shot. 5 questions, 5 answers in less than 30 seconds. Why is this important?
Because it improves our ability to work with vulnerable people.
What are the key areas?
The relationships we have with other people and the environment we work in needs to be at the forefront.
What can you do as a frontline worker?
Review your relationships and review your environments. What changes can you make?
What should you avoid?
Trying to do too much too soon and trying to do it all on your own. It's a journey everyone needs to be part of.
What will this mean for the future?
It will mean a better experience for those that use your service, better experience for you as a worker.
We're almost out of time today, but join us next time where we'll be covering complex trauma. Dave, can you just give us a quick sneak peek of what we'll be hearing about?
So the next podcast will be around complex trauma, and we will see how this naturally builds on a PI approach.
Don't forget to join us next time. I've been Chris Slater.
And I've been Dave Gill.
We'll see you next time on Frontline. Remember, this show is designed around you, so be sure to subscribe from wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to join us as a guest on the next show, our email is frontline@risk-and-resilience.co.uk or follow us at frontlinepod.